Okay. Hi, I am Helen, and I am an alcoholic. And I use my right last name. I just got married a couple months ago. My sobriety date is September 26, 1997. I am a member in good standing of the Buckingham Big Book Group. We meet on Tuesday nights at Maysville Baptist Church on Route 60 in Buckingham Courthouse, and on Monday nights in Dillon, and on Thursday nights in Dillon at other churches. It's an active group, and there's a clear message there. I started drinking probably without consequence as a teenager, 13-ish. And I remember getting together with the girls, and everybody brought something from home, and we mixed it all together. And sneaking, stealing. And I remember a very warm feeling, tingling. I was the oldest of four kids, and I was babysitting a lot for my siblings. And I remember being really scared as a kid. I remember thinking there were people looking in the windows when I was babysitting. I remember in school thinking that I was never going to graduate, that the end of the world was coming, that I'd never grow up, I'd never see 40. We'd never make it to the year 2000. All this real negative, dark thinking. Real crappy outlook on life early on. And it seemed when I drank that I didn't think about all that negative crap all the time. It made everything okay. I remember my brother was the smart one and my sister was the pretty one, so, you know, I was never quite enough. And when I drank and did other stuff, it didn't matter. I was okay. It made me okay. It made me comfortable in my own skin for the time being. I remember people saying, well, you gotta know your limits. And very often I would go beyond my limit, not knowing what that was. I was a early blackout drinker. I was a puker. I remember my friend JJ stealing a bottle of Royal Crown from her folks and drinking that and throwing up blood at 14, 15 years old, so I thought, well, I just won't drink brown liquor. And I was on this quest to figure out, you know, what the right combination was to put in there so that I would feel okay, but I wouldn't throw up or not remember what I did the night before. You know, how much stuff can I put in me but still remember the next day? It was quite a quest. In high school, my senior year, my schedule was such that I would leave and get in the car and drive around, have a couple of beers and some other stuff. And I got called to the principal's office one day, and he said, well, seniors have open lunch, they don't have open day. So he rearranged my schedule so that I signed in the office in the afternoon. So before I went to school, I would have a couple of beers and probably smoke a little weed. And the gym teacher pulled me aside one day, and he said, do you have a drinking problem? I said, no, I don't have a problem, I only had a couple. And back then, it really was only a couple, but I was 17 years old, and what was I doing drinking in the middle of the day and going to school? He never reported me, so there was no consequence to that. I didn't get in a lot of trouble drinking. Not with family, because my parents drank. They had parties. After my dad left, Mom said she'd rather have us at home than out on the streets getting in trouble. So it was party central at our house after that. I had occasion to drink with both my parents over the years. I don't think either one of them qualified to be here. I think they just liked to party. My siblings, on the other hand, probably would benefit from steps and meetings and whatnot, but that's not for me to say. I just try to be a good example. Anyhow, got through high school, didn't know what I wanted to do when I grew up, still don't know, and I thought college would be a waste of time, so I took the first of a couple of geographics and I moved to Houston, Texas with some friends, and had some horrendous things happen there. Discovered a morning drink. I never thought that I was a morning drinker, but I found that I was. I do remember drinking early in the morning. But there again, another control thing was, well, if you drink before noon, you know, you're an alcoholic, so you have to wait till afternoon. And working 11 to 7, it didn't count if you drank, because then that was really the evening after work. So that's how I justified that. Things didn't work out in Texas, and I went back to upstate New York. I enrolled in a community college, and it was there that I met him, who would become my ex-husband. He rode a Harley Davidson, had an 11-year-old son, and we were gonna build a house on a mountaintop and grow our own food and grow our own weed and live off the land and live happily ever after. That didn't happen. We loaded up a pickup truck and his kid and his dog and all our stuff and took off south. And landed on my brother's doorstep in Norfolk, Virginia. That's how I got to Virginia. He drank pretty heavily, but he would nag me about my drinking. It's like, well, why don't you slow down? I remember him telling me to slow down, slow down. Tequila was always trouble. If I drank liquor, I got in trouble because I was blacked out really early on. So over the course of those years, I mean, I had my gin period. I had my Southern Comfort period. It was always that quest, trying to find the right thing so that I wouldn't throw up or black out or pass out. And I always missed that mark. I remember thinking, well, if I eat before I drink, then I'll be okay. And that didn't work either. But I learned early on, don't drink on an empty stomach. I remember going on a blind date one time thinking that we were going to be having dinner, and there was no dinner. And I overdid it and ended up barfing all over. Didn't get asked out again. Anyway, on to Virginia, and started a family. It's only by the grace of God that I did not drink through my pregnancy. It made me physically ill, and somewhere I knew in the back of my mind that was a bad idea. And my daughter was born healthy, normal, which was none of my doing. We bought 10 acres of woods in Lunenburg County in southern Virginia, and moved out to the country and started building a log cabin. And moved into the log cabin, had no running water, plumbed in there, and one four-way electrical box, no stove. I did finally get a refrigerator. It was rough. Little House on the Prairie meets Susie Homemaker or something, I don't know. But as long as I had my beer or had some friends that had something, I was okay. I was actually miserable when I wasn't drinking. I hated myself. I hated my life. The bookmobile used to come to the next door neighbor's house, and somehow I got a hold of Betty Ford's autobiography. I guess it was, I don't know if she wrote it or not. It doesn't matter. Anyway, that was the first time I identified what my problem was. I knew that I was an alcoholic after reading that book. And probably the TV movie came out about then, too. I mean, I noticed my drinking was different than my friends in high school. But I wasn't positive I was an alcoholic until after identifying with Betty Ford. I called Alcoholics Anonymous. That would have been probably around 1986. And I left a message on an answering machine. And two or three days later, I got a call back saying, "We're sorry, there's nobody in your area." Yeah. And I just can't believe that in this day and age, because AA is pretty much everywhere. So my name's on a couple of 12-step lists as a result of that. But anyway, I started seeing this counselor, and I stopped drinking for, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks. And by that time, I was having some physical problems. I had gastritis. I had gone to my doctor. I told him I was an alcoholic. He didn't really have any suggestions. So sponsor your doctor, too. he did some medical tests, and yeah, I had some physical problems going on as a result of drinking. Stopped for about 2 weeks, talked to this counselor, and she seemed more interested in labeling me with an eating disorder and was worried about my relationship with my husband. The situation at home was unacceptable. And I was pretty miserable. But as long as I was drinking, it didn't matter. And I would take what there was there. I remember scaring my daughter to death, you know, hugging the toilet. I remember her telling me she was afraid I was going to die. And I remember wanting to die. I remember praying to God not to wake up in the morning. When I hear people share about their drinking being fun, I have a hard time identifying with that because my drinking was really dark, but my life was really dark. There was always that black cloud and that doom and gloom in the background. So we sold the little cabin in the woods and we moved to outside of Farmville in Cumberland County. Sold the 10 acres of woods, bought 20 acres, and started building another house. And still didn't have a bathroom. Got a bathroom, moved it to a place without a bathroom, which is the only reason why I mention it is because my last almost my second to last drunk. One more time, he told me, you know, do you know what you did last night? Da-da-da-da-da. Well, because we hadn't had the indoor plumbing, we had this little outside porta-potty, and I had gone out to go pee after we got home from partying with this couple. And just humiliated again, and the embarrassment, and the, you know, why am I going to keep doing this to myself? So the Tuesday after Memorial Day weekend in 1989, I called Alcoholics Anonymous out of the phone book in Farmville. And this man answered the phone. He said, come on down here and talk to us. There was this bookstore. There was a hotline at the bookstore. And I went down and I talked with this couple. And the woman gave me a big book. And she told me she'd be my sponsor. And I don't think I made it to a meeting until the following Sunday. Prior to making it to that meeting, he came home with a 12-pack, and I had told him I was joining Alcoholics Anonymous and I was going to quit drinking. And I knew I was going to be on my own. He didn't drink like I did. You know, he can drink too and leave it alone. I, on the other hand, you know, there's two or three beers left in the refrigerator from the night before. I'm going to drink that two or three, drive to the store, get another 6-pack, and drink until that two or three is left, so that when he comes home with the 12, it's still there. I didn't have to hide it. Didn't think. Anyway, I started going to meetings, and that very first meeting in Farmville was at the hospital. It was a Sunday morning. And I don't remember what we said. Don't remember what the topic was. But there was a feeling in that room. And I know today that was probably the beginning of some sort of spiritual awakening. It just felt right. I don't know how to describe it other than a feeling. I knew there was something there. And I started going to meetings. And I got involved. I showed up early. I helped set up. I helped clean up. There was this fellow, James, in Farmville, that he opened up two of the meetings that were there. And he headed up the New Year's party and the summer picnic, and he needed birthday cakes, so I made cakes and I helped with picnics, and I got really involved in the fellowship. That first sponsor, I called her a couple of times, and because she was running a business from that line, you know, she was too busy. And she really didn't have what I wanted. So I found this other woman who didn't have a phone, and I went over to her house, and we talked and fussed about her husband. So get a sponsor with a phone, and somebody who has a sponsor. She moved away, so I went sponsorless. And I went to meetings probably two or three times a week. There was only three meetings a week in Farmville at the time. And anything beyond that was just, like, too far away. I was not willing to go to any lengths. I didn't have a home group. I sponsored myself for a long, long time. I read all the AA literature. And years went on, and I got involved in another 12-step fellowship, and I had no singleness of purpose in my life, no primary purpose. Oh, that's distracting, I'm sorry. I worked the steps off the wall and had a pretty off-the-wall program. when I started going to these ACOA meetings, life at home got really, really uncomfortable because he continued to drink every day and smoke weed and abuse me. And at meetings, I was hearing about acceptance and don't take other people's inventory, so I'm thinking alone in my head that I have to accept my life the way that it is. And I ran away from home in 92, packed up my daughter and everything I owned and moved to my dad's and spent the summer there. And he came up to visit and said, you know, why can't you just have one glass of wine? I said, because I'm an alcoholic. And he said he understood. He said, come back. We'll try it for a year. If it doesn't work, you can leave with my blessing. So back to Farmville. And I didn't go to meetings for 6 months because it was two AA ladies that helped me pack up and move. And my pride was such that I could not go to meetings. And I would run into people in town, and they would say, how you doing? Oh, I'm fine, I'm fine. And finally, he and my daughter both said, don't you think you ought to go to a meeting? Because while I was gone, I went to a meeting every day, and I asked three or four women to sponsor me, and they all told me no. I had this young woman ask me to sponsor her, and I handed her Melody Beattie's Codependent No More. So I owe her a great amends. I don't remember her name. She had red hair. I had nothing to offer her. Anyway, finally made it back to meetings, and still didn't have a structure. Hit or miss going to meetings. Bucky had started up that Friday night Cumberland speakers meeting, which was to become my home group. And I went, I don't know, once a month, every couple of weeks, hit or miss. I remember going one Wednesday night to Farmville to a meeting, and I was just absolutely livid over something that was happening at home, a business deal, gone, whatever. But I was stark raving sober. And a couple of the women pulled me aside and said, don't you think you need to do an inventory? So I got a new sponsor, Judy. And Judy and I did actually do some work together. I did a take it to the grave inventory with her. She got all my secrets. And something started to change. You know, here all this time, sponsorless, you know, here the third step, turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. Somehow, in my arrogant, self-centered way, I thought that I had to understand God. And I spent all these years trying to figure out God. You know, what's God? Where's God? Who's God? And after I did that inventory, it was like gone, because God was in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a power there. Judy moved, and I made a couple of amends, I suppose, but I also started saying my prayers. I started practicing 10, 11, and 12 on a regular basis, because it was very haphazard prior to that. And my life was to change drastically. I went to my first, Judy gave me my first speaker tape, and that was, you know, like 93, 94. I had never heard speaker tapes. What were those? Where was I? Oh, let me say something real quick about the meetings in Farmville as well. They were open discussion meetings, and usually someone would come in with a problem, the problem of the week, and puke out a problem on the table, and then everyone would go around the table and share about how their opinion about what this person should do about their problem. There was very little talk about sponsorship, home group, steps, which I find pretty essential to my recovery today. In 1997, I went to my first convention. It was a state convention down in Hampton. And I had another wake-up call. And on the way home, I told my friend Bucky, I said, you know, I can't live this lie anymore. Things at home were unbearable. And I had come to realize that I did not have to accept the unacceptable. And I got honest with him. And he told me I was not an alcoholic. I had not had a drink in over 8 years. He said, those people have brainwashed you. And I said, well, I'll show you. And I got drunk at him. Now, mind you, I'm, again, sponsorless and still don't have structure as far as going to my home group on a regular basis and some of the other things that I do today. My daughter came home. Boy, she was mad, and she called Bucky, and Bucky got on the phone. He said, do you want me to come and get you? No, I'm drunk, and he made me promise that I would come to my home group the next day, because it was a Thursday afternoon. And I said, yeah, I'll be there. I'll either pick up a white chip or I'll turn in my key. And hopefully that was my last drunk. I had a horrible hangover. I was passed out on the bathroom floor. Got sick. That first sip and that warm, and it's like, whoo, we're off to the races now. It just took over that quick. The insanity returned. Well, probably never really left. But anyway, I committed myself to do 90 meetings in 90 days, which I thought was treatment center talk, but having read another 12-step book from another fellowship, I saw it in black and white, so I knew that wasn't treatment center talk. And got a new sponsor. Was calling her on a fairly regular basis. But she never offered to take me through the steps. So I approached this man and I asked him if he would be my sponsor, and he directed me to his wife. And she put structure in my life. She took me through the steps out of the book, the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And my thinking began to change a wee bit. My first experience with service was going to a jail meeting way back early on the first go-round, and that was really scary because they locked us up in the pod with the women. That didn't last very long. And then I went to a district meeting at one of those picnics, and there was a bunch of old people arguing, and I thought, I'm never going to get involved with that crap. Well, my friend Bucky, who I've mentioned a couple of times, was DCM at the district, and was secretary of the district. And I dragged him to these 90 meetings in 90 days, and he dragged me to a district meeting. He became DCM, and at 2 months sober, I became secretary of District 36 Southside. And I said, I can't. I just got drunk. And they said, yes, you can. And wow, what an amazing journey that has been. DCM is district committee member, and you facilitate the groups in your district and get them all together and have a meeting, and you just pass information from area, Virginia, and from New York, GSO, back and forth. You're just like a conduit. And you just facilitate this stuff. But I have met people all over Virginia. I've learned so much more about the traditions and how they apply to my life and how to practice those. It's just really enlarged my life in many, many ways. I went on to become alternate DCM, and then she resigned, and I was DCM, and then I love going to these area service functions, because you hear what's going on in AA all over the state, and I go home with these ideas, well, we can do this, and we can do that. You know, like, simple things like taking the meeting schedule to the sheriff's department or the health department, or, you know, just simple things. Different public information work or corrections work. There's amazing, the bigger world of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, there's so much more beyond not drinking and going to meetings. There is an entire psychic change, but there's a big, wide world out there. I remember looking in the mirror and thinking, what am I doing here on earth when I was drinking? And Alcoholics Anonymous put meaning and purpose in my life. And I don't have to figure it out. It's like, stay sober and help other people. You know, I don't have to think all the time. I try to figure things out. Oh boy, we've got a long time to go. Golly. I was fired by my sponsor. I'm still not sure why that relationship changed. I'm glad it did, because I have a wonderful relationship with her today, but I had to find another sponsor. And I picked a lady I was going into the jail with, and I really admired her spirit. But she also did not have that structure in her life. And it was too easy for me to think, well, geez, you know, she only goes to one meeting a month. So I knew I was going to get in trouble if I didn't change that. So I have found a new sponsor. I'm working with a woman in Richmond, and I drive there once a week, hour and 45 minutes away to a book study, and that has opened up all sorts of stuff. The girls helped with the wedding. It was amazing. It's been through working with others that I've learned more about myself. You know, I always looked at my suicidal thoughts as a bad coping skill. And, which oddly enough, after an inventory and doing 6 and 7, I haven't had thoughts of suicide. I've been relieved of that. But anyway, I was working with this woman, and it was made abundantly clear to me that that was a character defect, and I wouldn't have seen that without her. There's a woman in my life today that drives all the way out to my house over an hour once a week, and she's amazing. She's excited about Alcoholics Anonymous and how her life is changing. And I learned from her. Sponsors. Oh, my daughter. Yeah. I can talk about her all the rest of the whole night. One of my biggest fears with my daughter was that she was going to get pregnant. I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, I guess it was, she came to me, Mom, I'm in trouble, and I thought, uh-oh, here it is. And it wasn't. She said, Mom, I've been smoking crack. And instead of freaking out because of the steps and sponsorship and AA, you know, I was able to say, well, just stop. Get a sponsor. Work the steps. And she's clean today. She went to a few meetings. She did meet with a sponsor. she has found her recovery in church. You know, I treat her like a newcomer. I treat her like a sponsee. And my relationship with that, with her, with that young woman is absolutely amazing. She's stuck with me. She's told me stuff I don't want to know. It wasn't a formal fit stuff, but I mean, I know that I have that kind of relationship where she can tell me anything. And without AA, that never would have happened. 3 years ago, she did come over to the house. Mom, got some news. And yes, she was pregnant. But automatic. It was like, okay. She's not a teenager anymore. She's not addicted to crack. She doesn't have AIDS. There were other things, but they're not appropriate for the podium. Anyway, I came up with these positive things. You know, all the advantages of being a single mom versus being married. The father of my grandson is probably one of us, and that was scary for me. But how God could turn my greatest fear into the greatest joy in my life, because that little boy, it's just amazing. I was there. I went to Lamaze classes. I started seeing her once a week when she was pregnant. And we've continued that, and he's 3 years old now. But I made a commitment to that relationship. And to see that little person run up and say, Grandma, Grandma, with his arms open wide, and that's just amazing to me. To somebody who, way back when, you know, I'm never going to have kids, I'm not going to bring them into this horrible world. I don't know, it's just all pretty amazing to me. When I relapsed in 97, I got a phone call from my brother, and he didn't know that I had drank, and he decided that he was an alcoholic, and he called me for help, and I said, well, I can tell you how not to do it. I have a lot of experience with that. And I told him about the mistakes that I had made. I have another sister who I've tried to share with, and she put her hand on her hip and said, I don't need those damn meetings. So I have to be careful not to shove it down people's throats. I've learned more by making mistakes, I think. Trying to help somebody that it's not a matter of giving, but when and how to give. And I've learned that through the School of Hard Knocks, I guess. You know, if somebody wants this deal, you can't say anything wrong. And if they don't, you can't say anything right. I think we're done when we're done. I think it's really important to have a clear message. You know, I couldn't think my way out of a wet paper bag. It really took the actions here. You know, and this is a design for living. I never knew how to live. And I still make plenty of mistakes. But I have a way of living where I can be comfortable in my own skin. That doom and gloom is gone. And I think I'm done.